going for a long time in Qatar. Surely all this could and should have been done years ago, and all the lives that could have been saved and all the misery that has happened since then could have been reduced, if not completely avoided. Surely there's a huge lesson for us all here. But obviously, the priority at this very moment is to bring safety to those most vulnerable people in Afghanistan from the excesses of what the Taliban have done in the past. And
Jeremy Corbyn, we're going to have to leave it.
We're going to
have to leave it there, but we thank you so much for being with us. Former British Labour leader, one of the leading critics of the Afghan war in Britain from the beginning. And that does it for our show. I'm Mimi Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Stay safe.
KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm. Gabu Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Whiplash, Thursday, August 26th from 6:30 to 9:30 p.m. at Flight 64 Studio in Portland. Whiplash is an exhibition of printmaking from the cooperative members of Flight 64. Again, that's Whiplash on Thursday, August 26th from 6:30 to 9:30 p.m. at Flight 64, 2934 Northeast Alberta Street B in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Tune in Thursdays from 6 to 7 p.m. to hear Rose City Native Radio with your host, Jackie Malmstrom. Rose City Native Radio is a new public affairs program bringing you local and national Native issues and Native contemporary music. You can find more information about the show online at kboo.fm or find us on Facebook at Rose City Native Radio.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, American military service members are among those killed in an attack near the Kabul airport in Afghanistan.
We will not forgive. We will not forget.
There are plans to resettle some Afghan refugees in the West. And in Oregon and nationwide, this August is worse than last when it comes to the pandemic. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, August 26, 2021. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. 12 U.S. service members were killed and 15 others injured in a suicide bombing attack outside the Kabul airport in Afghanistan. At least 90 are dead, and 150 others were wounded in the bombing. KBOO's Althea Billings has more.
The bombing attack outside the Kabul airport today has been claimed by the Islamic State, or IS. The Pentagon confirmed that suicide bombers attacked a crowd at the gated entrance to the Kabul airport and at a nearby hotel. 11 U.S. Marines and one Navy medic are confirmed to have been killed, along with at least 90 Afghan civilians. The Afghanistan Ministry of Public Health reports that over 150 were wounded in the bombing, including men, women, and children. That makes today one of the deadliest days for U.S. service members in the 20 years since the Allied invasion of Afghanistan. The American service members are also the first to have been killed in Afghanistan since February 2020. Thousands of people have swarmed the Kabul airport since the city fell to the Taliban, trying to flee the country. The United States made a commitment to the Taliban to leave Afghanistan entirely by August 31st, and now the effort to evacuate U.S. citizens, military personnel, and allies has turned deadly. General Frank McKenzie described the attack in a press briefing today. McKenzie said the attack included two suicide bombers and was followed by gunmen opening fire with at least two explosions. McKenzie also said there are roughly 1,000 Americans left in Afghanistan and that there are, quote, extremely active threat streams at the Kabul airfield. An exclusive report by Politico found that the U.S. shared the names of Afghan allies who supported the United States with the Taliban in order to evacuate them. One anonymous defense official said the White House essentially gave the Taliban, quote, a kill list. President Biden addressed the bombing this afternoon.
These American service members who gave their lives, it's an overused word, but it's totally appropriate here, were heroes. Heroes who've been engaged in a dangerous, selfless mission to save the lives of others. They're a part of an airlift, an evacuation effort unlike any seen in history, with more than 100,000 American citizens, American partners, Afghans who helped us, and others taken to safety in the last 11 days. To those who carried out this attack, as well as anyone who wishes America harm, know this: we will not forgive. We will not forget. We will hunt you down and make you pay. I will defend our interests and our people with every measure at my command. Here's what you need to know. These ISIS terrorists will not win. We will rescue the Americans in there. We will get our Afghan allies. And our mission will go on. America will not be intimidated. And I have the utmost confidence in our brave service members who continue to execute this mission with courage and honor to save lives and get Americans, our partners, our Afghan allies out of Afghanistan.
That was an excerpt from President Biden's remarks this afternoon about the Islamic State-affiliated suicide bombings that killed 12 U.S. service members and at least 90 Afghans outside the Kabul airport. For KBOO News, I'm Althea Billings.
The American military has been using large aircraft like C-17 Globemasters to evacuate Americans and Afghan allies from the Kabul airport. In America, assistance agencies are getting ready for the arrival of refugees from Afghanistan in the next few weeks. Mark Richardson has more on the story from Utah.
Utah officials and private agencies are preparing to assist refugees from Afghanistan when they arrive in the Beehive State. Utah is one of 19 states designated to receive Afghan refugees in the coming weeks and months. Agencies such as the state's Refugee Resettlement Office and groups such as Catholic Community Services and the International Rescue Committee are lining up local volunteers and services to assist the immigrants. Aiden Batar with Catholic Community Services of Utah says the Afghan refugees are a special group.
The Afghan refugees that are coming to the United States, these are individuals who put their lives on the line helping our U.S. forces in Afghanistan for so many years. I think this is the smallest thing we can do by helping them and their families.
He says once they are evacuated from Afghanistan, the refugees will fly to a third country for initial processing, then will be brought to one of several intake sites in the United States for additional vetting. Batar says while there is no firm date for when the first group of refugees will arrive, he says Utah agencies are preparing to receive them in the near future.
Some states are already started getting some folks, but Utah, we're still waiting. I will say probably in the next week or in the next weeks, we should be getting some families arriving here in Utah.
Batar says Utah assistance agencies are looking for homes to place the refugees, agencies that can assist them with basic living needs such as clothes and furniture, and monetary donations to help the families settle in.
Special immigrant visa holders, those are the ones that have worked with the U.S. forces in Afghanistan, getting their permanent residency. So we have been appealing to our community to donate so we can provide the services that these vulnerable groups that are in need.
He adds that many of the Afghanis left the country with little or more than the clothes on their back and whatever they could carry in a small bag. To help, contact Catholic Community Services or the International Rescue Committee offices in Utah. I'm Mark Richardson for Arizona News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Some state representatives and local leaders are calling for the city of Portland to shut down Zenith Energy. The oil transport company is trying to expand its terminal along the Willamette River. The Portland Mercury reports that Zenith Energy is trying to get a land use compatibility statement from the city for its facility in Northwest Portland. It needs that approval before it can ask the state for more permits to expand its facility, but if the city denies the request, that would force Zenith to shut the facility down. 21 state representatives are asking the city to deny the request, citing the climate crisis and the risks of an oil spill. There are still to this day significant impacts in the environment from the infamous 1700 Pacific Northwest earthquake. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on what some new research reveals.
The research findings, published in the journal Natural Hazards and Earth System Sciences, demonstrated a tsunami related to the magnitude 9.0 earthquake led to slower growth in Douglas fir trees in the Newport area. The January 1700 quake was the last major earthquake in the Cascadia subduction zone. The zone extends from northern Vancouver Island to northern California. It has been home to many large earthquakes and volcanic eruptions, including the 1980 Mount St. Helens event. Core samples from a South Bend old-growth fir stand dating to at least 1650 showed the reduced growth, confirming a previous model. Research had shown evidence of the 1700 earthquake in trees in Washington State, and Oregon State University researchers thought similar evidence might exist in Oregon. They analyzed growth rates in the Douglas firs rings and compared them to rates in old-growth firs not present in the tsunami inundation zone. They are still trying to figure out why trees so far from the coastline were so badly affected. They suspect a combination of ground shaking and flooding by seawater. Models by the researchers show the involved area might have had 10 meters of water during a tsunami. The next step is to do additional wood analysis comparing to trees flooded by a 2011 tsunami in Japan. One goal is to develop a new technique to map prehistoric tsunamis all along the Pacific Northwest coast. Oregon State University Hatfield Marine Science Center Professor Robert Ziak says, quote, "Getting these little bits of the picture helps us understand what we might expect when the next big one hits," end quote. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Oregon is among 8 states that have broken their hospitalization records with more COVID-19 patients than at any time since the pandemic began. The other states are Kentucky, Texas, Arkansas, Florida, Louisiana, Hawaii, and Mississippi. Doctors are sounding the alarm about the highly contagious Delta variant circulating among mainly unvaccinated people, including growing numbers of children. There are now more than 1,000 hospitalized patients with COVID across Oregon. About 300 are in intensive care beds. Daily reports from the Oregon Health Authority are now regularly at more than 2,000 new cases a day. If you lose your job in Oregon because you refuse to get a COVID-19 vaccine, you probably cannot collect unemployment. That's the message from the Oregon Employment Department today. Acting Director David Gerstenfeld says requiring someone to be vaccinated during a global pandemic is a reasonable policy. He says if someone does not follow that policy without a good reason, it could result in their not being eligible for benefits. He says there are a few exceptions for those with a medical reason or a sincerely held religious belief. Oregon Governor Kate Brown has issued orders requiring vaccines for healthcare workers, teachers, and those who work in the state's executive branch. But few businesses in the state so far are requiring their workers to get the shots. This week, the Food and Drug Administration announced it is officially giving its full approval to the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine, so it is no longer under just an emergency use authorization. Many experts believe this will influence more people who are unvaccinated to get the shots. They include Professor Amy Huff at the Oregon State University School of Business.
I think this could be a watershed moment for a lot of Americans who have been hesitant to go ahead with vaccinations. When we think about people accepting or getting on board with a new technology like a vaccine, there's kind of three components to it. And one is how well the individual understands the kind of safety behind it. The second is the social norms around it, so whether their peers are getting it, whether it seems like the acceptable thing to do. And the third piece is whether the technology is sanctioned by appropriate governing bodies. And what we think is a shift there in that important third piece, where the governing bodies have signed off on this being a fully acceptable, legitimate intervention. So the fact that the government has approved of and the scientists have signed off on this vaccine being a safe and effective intervention for COVID could really shift consumers and citizens' opinions about the vaccine in favor of proceeding with vaccination.
You know, in your research of Oregon consumers and their attitudes towards the vaccine, did the fact that it was considered experimental come up a lot when they described why they were hesitant?
The fact that the vaccine was experimental came up a lot when we spoken with consumers. And what the FDA approval does is shift that, I think, in a lot of people's minds from being something that's considered experimental to something that's considered legitimate and safe and effective the same way that other approved medications and vaccines are.
So your thinking is that this we could see this as being a real shift then in getting the, those who are hesitant to get the vaccines.
Yes, I think this could be a real shift. I think that the first people to sign up for the vaccine back in the spring and through the summer have been those that are convinced and compelled based on their own understanding perhaps of the technology, based on what their friends and family and employers are requiring. And what this piece will do is provide a sense of legitimacy for people that were holding out for the formal approval of the U.S. government.
What are some of the other factors that are still driving the hesitancy? You were studying basically the mind of the consumers.
So there's a lot. Some of the hesitancy was arising from the fact that it seems to many people that this vaccine was available really quickly and was perhaps brought to market at what might be an unsafe timeline, when in fact there's been research going on the mRNA vaccine for years. And I think there's been a lack of communication from the media, from the governing bodies, about the safety of the vaccine as a result of it being the technology and the research and development behind it being around for a long time. So I think that was a piece that was missing in the communication to the general public, that scientists have been working on it for a long time. And again, I think the FDA approval addresses people that were hesitant primarily around that. There's also been, of course, a lot of misinformation communicated through media and through social networks about the safety of the vaccine, about side effects, supposed side effects. And again, I think this approval will kind of get at or address some of those concerns for people that were worried about untrue side effects that were communicated through misinformation about the vaccine. Another piece that is important here is the shift that we're seeing among employers, among experiences that consumers might want to do about vaccine requirements. So increasingly, we're seeing more employers require the vaccine, and I think we'll see more employers require that of their employees, and we'll see more customer-facing experiences, retail, theme parks, travel opportunities, and so on, be able to, in good faith, require their customers to be vaccinated.
That was marketing professor Amy Huff at the Oregon State University School of Business. The Newburgh School Board is facing some backlash and legal trouble for its recent ban on Black Lives Matter and gay pride flags on school property. Now the teachers' union in the district is filing legal action against the ban, saying it threatens their student safety. The ACLU of Oregon and some community organizers are also fighting the ban. Some are questioning the legality of both the ban and the way the board retained legal counsel to defend it. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact. It'll focus on a special court that's keeping Native Americans out of jail. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, the Indigenous Power Hour. Tonight's weather, partly cloudy skies, heading down to 56 degrees overnight. Tomorrow's weather, sunshine with some clouds peeking in, a high of 74. We're looking at sunny skies for the weekend and highs in the low 80s. Today in history, on this date in 1920, the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution was ratified, giving women the right to vote. The quote of the day is from Alice Paul, who said, "There will never be a new world order until women are a part of it." The United States has 93 nuclear reactors. That's down from 104 in 2012. Now more than 240 organizations, many of them in the West, have signed a letter calling on Congress to remove subsidies and investments in the nuclear power industry. Here's more from Eric Tegedoff.
Hundreds of groups have signed a letter opposing nuclear subsidies in Congress's infrastructure and budget reconciliation bills. The letter points to more than $50 billion in investments in nuclear power, including propping up aging plants, and says that will take away from movements toward climate, economic, and environmental justice. Lee Ford is head of the Snake River Alliance in Boise.
Our concern is the amount of money that goes to nuclear research, development, and old reactors, when a lot of that money could go to renewable that's faster and cheaper, and bailing out old, corrupt industries is not in our best interest right now.
Ford says the subsidies are only predicted to go toward 8 companies in as many states. Part of the money for research will likely go to small reactor technology being studied at the Idaho National Laboratory. Supporters say nuclear power is an emissions-free technology integral to the transition toward cleaner energy sources. Ford says money for nuclear energy would be better spent on the installation of renewables such as solar.
Solar is really fast as opposed to nuclear. It takes decades for nuclear. And another bad thing about nuclear is that one generation can use the power while several generations have to guard and store and treat the waste.
Some of the more than 240 organizations that signed the letter include Food and Water Watch, Indigenous Environmental Network, the League of Women Voters, and Physicians for Social Responsibility. For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
A judge has sentenced a man to more than 6 years in federal prison after he pleaded guilty to participating in a plot to kidnap Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer. Ty Garbin pleaded guilty to a kidnapping conspiracy charge and cooperated with federal prosecutors against his 5 co-defendants. Prosecutors say Garbin will be a star witness against the others. He apologized in court to Governor Whitmer and her family. He says he will work with an advocacy group to de-radicalize himself and try to keep others from becoming radicalized. The U.S. Supreme Court upholds the Remain in Mexico immigration policy. Officials are saying about 1,500 American citizens remain in Afghanistan. And the American Medical Association calls for broad vaccine mandates. With more on these stories, here's today's edition of 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We respectfully disagree with the district court's decision, and we regret that the Supreme Court has declined to issue this stay. DHS has appealed the district court's order and will continue to vigorously challenge it.
White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki reacts to the Supreme Court's refusal to block a court ruling ordering the Biden administration to reinstate a Trump-era policy that forces people to wait in Mexico while seeking asylum in the U.S. The court said the administration likely violated federal law in its efforts to rescind the program informally known as Remain in Mexico. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett met Wednesday with President Joe Biden in the midst of heightened tensions with Iran, and as Israel grapples with a gradual resurgence of hostilities on its southern border with the Gaza Strip. In its first state visit overseas since taking office, Bennett met separately with Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and Secretary of State Antony Blinken. Blinken said the department estimates there are 6,000 Americans who want to leave Afghanistan, and 4,500 have already left the country. He also said since August 14th, more than 82,000 people have been safely flown out of Kabul. Blinken indicated that there could be as many as 1,500 American citizens remaining.
These are dynamic calculations that we are working hour by hour to refine for accuracy.
The United States recorded 1,400 new COVID-19 deaths and 150,000 new cases Tuesday as the highly contagious Delta variant continues to spread. Meanwhile, the American Medical Association has called for broad vaccine mandates. The AMA's liaison to the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, Dr. Sandra Fryhofer, on the Delta variant.
It's the most contagious variant we've seen yet. There's emerging evidence Delta causes more severe illness than previous strains. The greatest risk of transmission is still among unvaccinated people, but fully vaccinated people with breakthrough infections can also spread virus.
Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has ordered service members to immediately begin receiving the COVID-19 vaccine, according to a Pentagon memo released Wednesday. No timeline was given for when troops are required to get the shot, but Austin said he directed service branch secretaries to impose ambitious timelines. Finally, a House committee investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol is seeking a trove of documents from the Trump administration, giving White House record keepers 2 weeks to turn over information relating in any way to former First Lady Melania Trump, Ivanka, Eric, and Donald Trump Jr., son-in-law Jared Kushner, as well as members of Congress and Hill staffers. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The Chickasaw Nation will offer the FDA-approved Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine exclusively. And a South Dakota group has a plan to improve Native-owned tourism. With these stories and more, here's National Native News, the daily report dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Trip Carlson for Antonia Gonzalez. The largest organization of Alaska Native tribes and Native corporations announced that it will postpone its annual convention to mid-December. In a news release, the Alaska Federation of Natives says health and safety concerns, including an increase in COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations statewide, factored into the decision. The Alaska Federation of Natives plans to hold a December in-person convention in Anchorage with a virtual option. The board will make a final decision on the 2021 convention in mid-October. The exact dates, time, and agenda will be announced at a later date. Tourism is South Dakota's second largest industry, bringing in billions of dollars. But Native American-operated tourism is underdeveloped. And the South Dakota Native American Tourism Alliance wants to change that. Ariel Zions of South Dakota Public Broadcasting reports.
The Native in the South Dakota Native Tourism Alliance doesn't just mean tourism about Indigenous people. It means tribes and tribal members participating and profiting from the industry. The group has a plan to support Native Americans interested in tourism and to improve marketing for attractions that already exist. Do Bad Warrior Ganji is a member of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe and vice president of the Black Hills Powwow.
I think the South Dakota Native Tourism Alliance is a potential revenue source for our tribes, and it's a way for our tribes to generate income, alleviate poverty, and help us to conserve our natural resources and culture.
The Tourism Alliance is identifying experiences along existing scenic routes. This will usher tourists through different tribal lands while encouraging collaboration and skill sharing among tribes. Gus Yellowhair and his daughter Tiana are Northern Cheyenne and Oglala Lakota. They own Tatanka Res Tours, which has been giving tours of the Pine Ridge Reservation and the Black Hills for 7 years.
The economic situation on the reservation is like almost 60% to 70% unemployment. And so we have big dreams and big ideas of being able to help the tribe with that portion of it by training young people in areas of tourism, in areas of art, possibly working, with the state or with the government on, opening up a facility on federal land. We're gonna approach them with that. And I think it's only fair that we get a piece of the pie.
The Tourism Alliance will share its 5-year plan and new website during a launch party in Rapid City. For National Native News, I'm Ariel Zients.
The Chickasaw Nation Department of Health will exclusively offer the FDA-approved Pfizer vaccine. On Monday, the Food and Drug Administration announced it had approved the use of the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine for people 16 years and older. The vaccine also continues to be available under emergency use authorization for children 12 to 15 years of age, and as an additional booster dose for immunocompromised individuals. Chickasaw Nation offers COVID-19 vaccines to everyone, regardless of tribal citizenship, employment, or residency. The American Basketball Association will launch an initiative that will feature Native American players from across Indian country. The ABA announced Warlance Foster to be the CEO of the initiative, Native ABA. Foster says the Native ABA will allow Native Americans the opportunity to develop basketball skills through training, discipline, and hard work. The St. Regis Mohawk Tribe will offer a $100 gift certificate to give people incentive to receive the COVID-19 vaccine beginning September 1st. According to the tribe, based in Akwesasne, New York, tribal members and its employees and employees of the Akwesasne Mohawk Casino and other enterprises are eligible. The gift certificates are intended for people who have not previously been vaccinated. The Cowlitz Indian Tribe in southwest Washington has called off its 2021 powwow due to an increase in COVID-19 cases. The tribe says that vendors who have paid to set up for the 2021 event will be reimbursed. For National Native News, I'm Trip Krause.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, August 26, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Althea Billings, Eric Tegedoff, and Mark Richardson. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us for the KBOO Evening News. Now stay tuned for Making Contact on a special court keeping Native Americans out of jail. That's coming up next.
You're listening to Making Contact.
I'm Salima Hamrani, and on today's Making Contact.
So when I first came into the wellness program, I did not like the smudging. I did not like that they talked about ceremonies. So it did take me a while to open up to the court being so open towards my culture.
Our friends at 70 Million take us to the Penobscot Nation, where a new court helps Native communities deal with their addiction without jail time.
They said, you know what we want is we want a problem-solving court. I said, great. What's a problem-solving court? The chief kind of cocked an eyebrow and said, figure out what the problem is and solve it. And that has changed my life around the law significantly.
The courts mix traditional healing methods with therapeutic interventions in order to deal with the trauma that underlies addiction for Native communities. And it seems to be working. Stay tuned. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Making Contact. Today, we're learning about a new way to deal with addiction in Native communities. Because jail is inexpensive and re-traumatizes individuals, it's often not an effective way to deal with a deeper cultural and mental health issue. So, the Penobscot Nation decided to try something else. Here's Mitzi Miller from the podcast 70 Million talking about the healing to wellness courts.
In Maine, over 9,000 people are Native Americans, with 4 federally recognized tribes in the state. The Penobscot Nation is determined to keep tribal families together, even as the community struggles with addiction. The nation also has exclusive jurisdiction over certain crimes that happen on their land. And that jurisdiction lets them respond to those crimes without jail. The Penobscot Reservation extends for miles alongside 15 towns and includes several islands in the Penobscot River. On Indian Island, a small community of about 570 people, there were 216 offenses involving drugs or alcohol between 2013 and 2016. Those numbers are one of the reasons the Penobscot Nation set up a separate court for tribal members dealing with addiction. They didn't want to keep jailing their own people who were struggling with substance abuse. Instead of punishment, there's positive reinforcement. In their court, there's a mix of Native culture, close supervision, and recovery backed by science. They're sending fewer people to jail, and those who go through their Healing to Wellness Court stay clean and sober longer. Reporter Lisa Bartfy has our story.
It's 8 a.m. sharp on a Friday morning at the end of February when the court session on Indian Island starts. The court hearing is held in a medium-sized room, partly covered with wood paneling. The blonde wood and the art around the room make it feel less like a courthouse and more like a community center. Every seat is taken when Judge Eric Maynor asks Kristen Nicola to rise.
We are on the record in the Penobscot Nation Healing to Wellness Court. We'll have you please rise. I want to talk to you a little bit more about how you're doing. So how are things going for you?
Good.
Yeah, how's school going?
Good.
Is it still going well?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's fantastic to hear.
No, I'm going to be taking creative writing. I'm taking English 101 this semester.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So creative writing, what other things are you thinking about taking?
I'm signed up for anatomy and physiology, but that's two classes that used to remain, and then calculus 1 and creative writing.
Holy Christmas. Mm-hmm. That's just amazing.
Thanks.
Things going well with baby?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. She's doing good.
Is it to go on well and all
yeah.
that? Yeah, they're going back and forth. And
yeah, it's okay.
Okay. Well, that's good. And we've got you at 381 days.
At 22, Kirsten's been clean and sober for 381 days, over a year. That's a huge personal victory. But it's also important for Judge Maynard. This is a drug court, and drug testing 3 times a week is part of their program. Judge Maynard sanctions those who've been in the program as long as Kirsten has if they don't test clean. Sometimes that means jail. Indian Island is a small island in the Penobscot River in Maine, and it's also part of the Penobscot Nation's reservation. Kirsten's a member. I visit her at home on Indian Island a week after the drug court session. It is a beautiful house.
Thank you.
It's a beautiful house on a beautiful piece of land, and your name is the same name as the street name.
Yeah, this was my grandparents' house, and they named the street after our last name.
During the day, Kirsten is studying to get into medical school.
Well, I really want to be a psychiatrist. I don't think that my community has a very good grasp on mental health, and my ultimate goal is to have a program that's more focused on mental health and medications.
The goal of becoming a psychiatrist and helping people with their mental health came out of an experience Kirsten had a couple years ago, shortly after she gave birth to her daughter.
All of my mental health stuff, it had been going on when I was pregnant. I was battling depression when I was pregnant, but it all came to a head like a month after she was born, and I ended up having to go to jail in the psychiatric hospital, so I didn't see her for a month. And then I was in court with my ex-husband, and it was felt that I wasn't stable enough to see her, so there was another 3 months that I didn't see her, and it was a really hard year of not having her all the time, because it's definitely not how I pictured our life together.
A lot has changed since then. Today, Kirsten is healthy and sober. She says she shares custody of her daughter. Life is calm and good. She made her way out of addiction with the help of a special court on the Penobscot Reservation. It's called the Healing to Wellness Court. It's a program for tribal members who end up in court and are struggling with substance abuse. And Kirsten says participating in their program has kept her out of jail. The Healing to Wellness Court sessions where I first meet Kirsten is different from other drug courts. It's easy to see that this is a Native court. Proceedings start with a smudge and prayer. A big guy who's been half asleep until that point volunteers to smudge everyone. He lights a sage and carefully carries it around the room. He makes a brief stop in front of every person in the circle and lets the smoke waft over and around them. Rhonda DeConti is the court clerk and cultural advisor at the Penobscot Nation's court. She's Penobscot too, And she's the one who incorporated Penobscot tradition and ceremonies into the court's routines.
So when I look at things, I look at it through an Indigenous lens. So as the deputy clerk, I'm the person who's recording the session, who's taking those notes, you know, and also watching everybody in the courtroom. So my first suggestion was, let's remove these tables. Like, why do we need to have them? Why can't we sit in a circle, you know, support each other and come together? And I proposed that to Judge Maynard, and he's like, couldn't think of a reason why we needed to have the table. So we gave it a try, and it's been a part of our session ever since then.
Judge Eric Maynard presides over the Healing to Wellness Court. He's the only one who's not inside the circle.
But I stay on the bench and wear the black robe because of the experience that our participants have had in court systems has typically been the person wearing the black robe is going to punish me, and they're going to say bad things to me. If a court system has done that, and then they need to hear when they've done something well, that court system needs to say, you've done really good here.
Judge Maynard asks everyone something personal and specific about their life, like a job search or a move. It feels like people are talking with a nice but strict uncle. But it's actually a review hearing to assess if they're in compliance with their court orders. Kirsten talks to the judge. Then she offers support to a participant who's struggling with staying clean.
I was thinking, like, I was drinking and using for like 6 years, and like pretty much that whole time I did not want to quit. So like, if we just use that mindset for this, like, it probably would make it go by easier too. So, like, I don't know. I think you're doing a really good job, and I'm happy to be here with you, and yeah, just keep it up.
Judge Maynard is not a Penobscot tribal member, but he's been working for the tribe since 2008.
When I first came here, the chief and counsel, they interviewed me and then said, okay, one of the things we've seen is we've seen how the Anglo court works. $350 fine, next, $350 fine, next. They said, that doesn't work here, and that's not what we want. And so they said, you know what we want is we want a problem-solving court. And I said, great. What's a problem-solving court? The chief kind of cocked an eyebrow and said, figure out what the problem is and solve it. And that has changed my life around the law significantly.
For Judge Maynard, prison as punishment is not as appealing. He says the tribe pays a fee to the neighboring county to use their jail, and incarceration is expensive.
I know what the cost is. The cost to put someone in jail for a year is about $35,000. To put someone in prison in Maine, they told me was about $48,000. The cheapest you can send anyone to jail is $28,000, and that's in Alabama. Nobody wants to go to jail in Alabama. Our program, we run on about $7,500 a year per participant. So the economics driving the program argue strongly for diversion. The moral equation, as far as the program goes, argues even more strongly for diversion. What we see oftentimes, and you hear a number of the participants talking about it, is how important their children are to them. And we're talking about helping parents work their way through recovery and changing a paradigm. Changing a paradigm not only for the parent, but for the child in the future.
The tribal court has jurisdiction over misdemeanors that happen on their land that can earn a person up to a year in jail. Judge Maynard can still sentence someone to serve time, but people with substance abuse problems get the option to enroll in Healing to Wellness Court instead.
In the wellness court, the last time we sent someone to jail was over 2 years ago. We were fairly heavy in when we started, and it just wasn't effective. It led to more people dropping out. What happens now is we get some peer norming. As you see, we have some individuals who've been in the program a long time. Their periods of sobriety are significant, and it just becomes the norm within the wellness court that the expectation is that there will be sobriety. And it's rather than an enforced, it's peer norming.
The Healing to Wellness Courts are built on the idea that it's traumatic for someone to be arrested. It's the kind of experience that brings problems like substance use to the surface.
When I was in jail, it kind of felt like that's where all of my inner turmoil and that's where all of my past trauma, that's where all of that malfunction in my life wanted me to be. And that's where I still would have been.
When I ask her about that malfunction in her life, she mentions her parents. She doesn't know her dad, but she knows he's an alcoholic. And she describes her mom as very abusive.
I have been raising my siblings. My sister was born when I was 8. My brother was born when I was 11. And I really took responsibility of them when I was around 12. And along the way, I did get adoptive parents, and they are very good role models for parenting. They're very excellent parents to me and my two brothers.
Kirsten says she started drinking as a teenager. She also got in trouble with the law because of it.
I threw a party at this house, actually, and I got charged with furnishing a place for minors to consume, even though I was also underage. But I understand that it was my house, so I did get in trouble for it. But I'm really grateful now that it happened, because if it hadn't happened, I'd probably still be doing it.
In Maine, less than 1% of the population is Native. But among the incarcerated women, 5% are Native. There's not only an overrepresentation of Native American women in Maine's prison system. More Native American people die of opioid overdoses than any other group in the country. 1 in 11 Native Americans, or Alaska Natives, is living with a disease of substance use disorder. These two things, high numbers of addiction and incarceration, are part of why the Healing to Wellness Court started. Dr. Maria Yellowhorse Braveheart is an associate professor of psychiatry. She studies historical trauma and substance use disorders in Indigenous communities. Here she is talking to adjunct professor Tanya Greathouse at Smith College about it.
So there are ways to heal from that, both traditionally in traditional culture, mm-hmm. but also incorporating what we know now about healing and alcoholism and trauma Absolutely. And PTSD and complex or grief, complicated grief or prolonged grief and yeah. all of this knowledge that we've gained over many years.
The Healing to Wellness Court works with all of those pieces, behavioral therapy and traditional healing, to help participants through recovery and stay out of jail. I reach Chris Pacheco on the phone in another part of the country, far away from the snowy banks of the Penobscot River, near Albuquerque in the high desert. Chris is at her home on the Pueblo of Laguna Reservation. She's a licensed alcohol and drug abuse counselor and has been instrumental in setting up Healing to Wellness Courts across the country. She says there are a lot of reasons so many women end up in similar situations.
It's such a multitude of issues, and there are so many theories among my fellow clinicians and, you know, people in academia about why Native communities are so hard hit. You know, you can go back to theories of our historical trauma.
Chris's people, Pueblo of Laguna, are still where they've always been, on Native land now called New Mexico. But there's at least one historic legacy they have in common with the Penobscot: industrial pollution. For the Penobscot, it's been chemicals from paper mills running into the Penobscot River. The Penobscot can't continue with a traditional diet because the fish are too poisoned. Dr. Yellowhorse Braveheart says that not being able to practice one's traditional culture has big consequences.
All cultures have wisdom in what their practices mm-hmm. are, have been, that fits with their culture. And right. so when you can't practice it in that way, that's one way of stunting the grief or trapping Absolutely. The grief.
This grief that Dr. Yellowhorse Braveheart talks about goes deep. She traces it back to the history of removal and massacres in the 19th century.
Being survivors of massacres, you know, like the Wounded Knee Massacre mm-hmm. and the mass graves where those ceremonies couldn't be performed at that time. Those are things that affect people, and that the grief and the trauma just gets carried on and on.
Researchers like Dr. Yellowhorse Braveheart theorize that historical trauma is associated with increased risk of substance abuse and increased vulnerability to mental health disorders among Native American people today. Some of the generational traumas aren't even that far in the past. American boarding schools took Native American children from their parents as recently as the 1970s. That happened to Pueblo Laguna and Penobscot children.
You know, and these were not boarding schools to educate us. It was to make workers out of us, but also to teach us to be non-Native, to be part of the larger American society at that time. So what happened with that generation of individuals was that loss of culture, loss of identity, a complete loss.
Chris thinks that those experiences of loss and family separation are still having an effect on Native Americans today.
And so you get to individuals today who've gone through all of these years and all of this loss that, you know, it's this coping mechanism of trying to find something to make them feel better, whether it be, you know, a substance, whether it be another form of an addiction.
And those losses continue. Statistics show that proportionally more Native American children are in the foster care system than kids from other groups. And with few Native American families as foster parents, that's a new generation growing up away from their own culture. Family separation comes up in Healing to Wellness Court 2. In the courtroom in Maine, the morning I visit, one participant stands out.
Everything's going well with my lawyer, with my kids. I'm hoping to hear of a court date soon. I'm hoping that, you know, I'll finally get to see my daughter other than video chat, because it's just not enough. I would love to give my daughter a hug, to spend time with her and my son as well, but like, I haven't seen my daughter in like 3 years, so.
The Healing to Wellness Court can't rule on child protective cases. Participants hope that being enrolled in the Wellness Court shows that they're committed to staying clean and changing their ways, and that it will work in their favor when they go up to have their child protection cases heard. Being a parent dealing with substance abuse is hard, even for those who have their kids. Judge Maynard reprimands a young woman for missing recovery meetings. She's 31 days sober, and life is still a bit chaotic.
I just need that push, and it's like, I'm hoping like by this weekend I can probably like settle things in my household down enough. And I think also once we get that baby into some child care, it'll be easier for me as well.
She's still in the early days of recovery, but she's already made a huge turnaround in just 1 month. Judge Maynard sees that she's trying hard, even if she's missing recovery meetings.
For individuals that are in the throes of the disease, the world is chaos. And that's a tough place to be. A real tough place to be. And to be able to say, no, it's not chaos anymore.
No.
I don't have control of everything. None of us do. But be real proud of where you are.
Yeah, thank you.
And I appreciate the insights that you shared today.
A Healing to Wellness Court is a drug court similar to the ones that were introduced in the late 1980s. But this one was created with money from the Department of Justice for Native Americans to address that loss that researchers like Dr. Yellow Horse Braveheart and clinicians like Chris Pacheco identify in their communities. Like other drug courts, it approaches addiction as a disease that should be treated instead of punished. It's an alternative to a jail or prison sentence, where people are assigning drug treatment and close supervision instead of serving time.
There's a feeling about it that just feels very comforting and welcoming. And so I think that's what bringing culture into that Healing to Wellness Court does. You know, even for some of our participants who may not have been fully immersed in their culture for whatever reason, maybe they've grown up away from the community, or they've been caught up in their addiction that they haven't reconnected to their culture. This is a safe place for them to reconnect to their culture.
The Penobscot Nation has had a drug court since 1999, but it wasn't until years later that it really took shape as the culturally responsive court they have today. Rhonda DeConte has been involved in the Wellness Court since 2011.
We've had a sweat lodge in the back of the courtroom since we moved to our new location. There's always a meal that I prepare, and they're always welcomed. If they're not comfortable with going in, maybe they can help with some of the meal preparation, you know, sit at the fire and just kind of be engaged that way.
Social workers, drug and alcohol abuse counselors, family counselors, and community elders working along with the judge, prosecutor, and public defender are all part of the Healing to Wellness Courts. Brianna Tipping is one of these experts. She's one of the non-Native members of the team, and she's the court's case manager and probation officer. She calls the people going through court participants, and she says they come in every 2 weeks.
You know, we come in and talk about how they're doing, and then we have a review hearing in the courtroom so that they get to tell us how they're doing, and we get an opportunity for the whole group of not just participants, but the team members that are present to share, here's how we think you're doing, and give that encouragement. So it's building community, and it's using culture as a healing tool. So it's not a typical review hearing. We're on the record, and there are consequences that can, you know, come out of that. You heard some people have community service that they have to do as a consequence for being out of compliance.
A slim young man came to court and reported back on his community service.
I helped Pat move into her new office. Got some stuff for my apartment, just like, I don't know, it was like some Tupperware and some cups and stuff, but it was really nice. I didn't really like look at it as like community service. It was just like helping. You know, I think like the whole it being court order though just kind of gave me the push I needed to actually like go and do it, you know.
Typically, you know, we're looking at therapeutic responses to missteps as well. So if you're missing counseling appointments or if you're, you know, missing other pieces of your treatment plan, sometimes we'll give you a writing assignment, doing a goodbye letter to their addiction. That's a therapeutic tool that we use for reflection, because that's a huge part of this process, is kind of giving over some of that power for you. Living the way that you've lived for so long has brought you to where working with us, where we're asking you to try things a little bit differently.
It took Kirsten Nicola a while to warm up to some of this stuff.
So when I first came into the wellness program, I did not like the smudging. I did not like that they talked about ceremonies because they were not Native. So when you grow up being subjected to racism, you kind of put up a shield around yourself. So it did take me a while to open up to the court being so open towards my culture. But now that I am, it's a lot easier for me to accept them. And it's also easier for me to relate to life outside of court. Now that I know that people are willing to accept my culture and to not be ignorant towards that part of me, it's easier for me to relate to people that are not Native.
Kirsten shudders to think what would have happened without the Healing to Wellness Court.
I probably would have stayed in jail longer. I probably would not have gone to rehab. I was against rehab from the beginning. For some reason, I had this idea in my head that I didn't have a problem and that I could just face it on my own. I think that I've always been like that. And so if they hadn't fought for all the supports that they did, I probably would not be where I am today. I'd probably still be in active addiction. I probably would still be an abusive person. And I might even be in jail still.
The court has changed Judge Maynard, too.
I tell everybody this is the best job I've ever had. I think far and away it's the best work that I've been able to be part of. And I am just a part of it. We have 15 different department members of our wellness court team that meet, give up their time to meet every other Wednesday to sit down and discuss the challenges that the individuals face. Yeah, it has changed my view of the law significantly.
Back at that early morning courtroom session on Indian Island, Kirsten is standing up with her hands folded in front of her. She shifts her weight from one foot to the other when Judge Maynard and her case manager, Brianna, talk about her progress in the program.
Your daughter has an amazing example of what a strong mama looks like, so I'm just really proud of you.
Kirsten was about to enter the last phase of the program, called the Sweetgrass phase, when I last talked to her. In Sweetgrass, participants prepare for life after wellness court, how to stay clean and healthy, and how to be positive members of the community.
What medicine do you bring? Rhonda wanted us to talk about that today.
I don't know. I guess, like, helping people, like, and my passion to help those less fortunate than me.
You were just listening to 70 Million and their episode entitled A Special Court Keeping Native Americans Out of Jail. Thanks to their special reporter, Lisa Bartfi, and the whole 70 Million team, and that's it for today's show. To get a full list of credits and a link to a toolkit from 70 Million about the Healing to Wellness Courts, visit us at radioproject.org. You can also visit us on Twitter and on Instagram, we're Making Contact Radio Project. The Making Contact team includes Sonia Green, Monica Lopez, Anita Johnson, Sabine Blazin, and I'm Salima Hamrani. Thanks for listening to me.
Listening to Rose City Native Radio. Low Res Edition. Stay tuned for music, Super Indian, and all your favorites coming up on today's show.